This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. Hello, this is Natalie Pynchon. I'll be reading summaries of articles on oncology, traumatic brain injury, and vascular disorders published by the Journal of Neurosurgery on April 18, 2014. Endoscopic resection of incidental choloid cysts, a clinical article by Konstantinos Margetis and colleagues. The removal of an incidentally diagnosed choloid cyst has been, until now, a counterintuitive and objectionable treatment option. The risk of sudden death, however, while infrequent, continues to haunt the patient or surgeon faced with the prospect of surveillance monitoring rather than cyst removal. Craniotomy and microsurgery for choloid cysts has fittingly never tipped the balance of treatment for an incidentally diagnosed lesion in favour of removal. However, the established negligible risk profile associated with endoscopic choloid cyst removal may provoke a reappraisal of surgical indications to include incidental lesions. The authors of the present study consider the prospect of using a minimally invasive method to treat asymptomatic patients. They have shown, for the first time, that the endoscopic removal of incidental choloid cysts can be performed without complications and with no greater risk than when the procedure is done in symptomatic patients with overt ventricular enlargement. This experience forces a reassessment of the established therapeutic recommendation for select patients with incidentally diagnosed choloid cysts. Pressure autoregulation monitoring and cerebral perfusion pressure target recommendation in patients with severe traumatic brain injury based on minute-by-minute monitoring data. A clinical article by Bart de Prater and co-authors. In the management of severe traumatic brain injury, the target of 70 millimeters of mercury for cerebral perfusion pressure has been abandoned. Monitoring of autoregulation capacity appears to be a promising tool for determining dynamic cerebral perfusion pressure targets. The pressure reactivity index has been demonstrated to be a reliable tool for monitoring cerebrovascular pressure autoregulation at the bedside. Plotting pressure reactivity index against cerebral perfusion pressure allows for determining the cerebral perfusion pressure area of most active autoregulation, called optimal cerebral perfusion pressure. However, monitoring of pressure reactivity index requires additional software for handling waveform quality data. Moreover, the method for determining optimal cerebral perfusion pressure only produces this target in about two-thirds of monitoring time. In the present study, the authors developed a method for pressure reactivity monitoring based on minute-by-minute intracranial pressure and blood pressure data. This method uses intracranial pressure and blood pressure correlation coefficients over different time intervals and plots these against cerebral perfusion pressure over different time windows in order to maximally exploit the information on pressure reactivity available in the data. The authors were able to demonstrate that optimal cerebral perfusion pressure obtained by the new method compared well with optimal cerebral perfusion pressure obtained by the pressure reactivity index method. Moreover, the new method was able to produce an optimal cerebral perfusion pressure target in over 90% of monitoring time. Platelet-mediated changes to neuronal glutamate receptor expression at sites of microthrombosis following experimental subarachnoid hemorrhage. A laboratory investigation by Joshua Bell and co-authors. Glutamate is believed to be potentially neurotoxic. The glutamate hypothesis states that excess glutamate release in the brain causes excitotoxicity and brain damage. The blood-brain barrier excludes glutamate from the brain when we ingest it in our diet. Interestingly, platelets contain high concentrations of glutamate, and platelets may leak into the brain after subarachnoid hemorrhage. The authors of this study investigated whether platelets and glutamate get into the brain after subarachnoid hemorrhage. The results show that they in fact do. In addition, the authors present some evidence that this novel mechanism could cause brain damage after subarachnoid hemorrhage. Anterior cerebral artery bypass for complex aneurysms. An experience with intracranial to intracranial reconstruction and review of bypass options. A clinical article by Adib Adnan Abla and Michael Lawton. The goal of this paper is to describe an experience with intracranial to intracranial bypasses for complex anterior cerebral artery aneurysms with giant size, dolichoectatic morphology, or intraluminal thrombus, and to determine how others have addressed such cases with bypass, and to discuss the salient microsurgical technique. 10 patients with complex anterior cerebral artery aneurysms were treated with anterior cerebral artery bypass. In situ bypasses were used in 4 patients, namely A3 to A3 bypass. Interposition bypasses were used in 4 patients, reimplantation in 1 patient, and reanastomosis in 1 patient. Complete aneurysm obliteration was demonstrated in 8 patients, and bypass patency was demonstrated in 8 patients. There was no operative mortality, and permanent neurological morbidity was observed in 2 patients. At the last follow-up, 8 patients were improved or unchanged. In a review of the 29 published reports, the A3 to A3 in situ bypass was used most commonly, and extracranial to intracranial bypasses were the second most common. Anterior cerebral artery aneurysms requiring bypass are rare and can be revascularized in a variety of ways. These aneurysms require a thorough survey of patient-specific anatomy and microsurgical options before deciding on an individualized management strategy. Bypass is a reasonable alternative to direct clip reconstruction for complex aneurysms. Low risk for subsequent subarachnoid hemorrhage for emergency department patients with headache, bloody cerebrospinal fluid, and negative findings on cerebrovascular imaging. A clinical article by Lisa Thomas and co-authors. The current approach to assess for subarachnoid hemorrhage in patients who present to an emergency department with an acute headache includes non-contrast head CT and, if the findings are negative, lumbar puncture to assess for red blood cells or xanthochromia. The authors hypothesized that emergency department patients with acute headache who have normal findings on head CT with red blood cells in their cerebrospinal fluid but no aneurysm or vascular lesion on CT or MR angiography are at low risk for subsequent subarachnoid hemorrhage. A retrospective case series with standardized longitudinal follow-up was performed on 181 emergency department patients with acute headache, blood in the cerebrospinal fluid, and negative findings on cerebrovascular imaging. Over a median follow-up period of more than 4 years, none of the 181 patients had a subsequent subarachnoid hemorrhage or new vascular lesion. 10% complained of a new headache or other complication after lumbar puncture. No angiography complications were identified. This study provides evidence supporting the presumed favorable prognosis of these patients. It suggests they are indeed safe for discharge. Results further suggest that for some patients with an acute headache and negative findings on head CT, either CT angiography or MRI angiography may be a reasonable alternative to lumbar puncture. The authors consider the risks and benefits of such an alternative approach and avenues for future research. Thank you for listening. The JNS mobile app is now available in iTunes and the Google Play Store. Just search for JNSPG to download the app for your mobile device today. For more information on how to submit your research to the Journal of Neurosurgery, please visit thejns.org and click on Info for Authors.